I'm Peter Solomon, and you're listening to Jazz 88. And I have the pleasure today to speak with Ethan Iverson, a pianist who formerly was with The Bad Plus and has been doing his own projects for the last several years. His most recent album, his second for the Blue Note label, is called Technically Acceptable. We'll be talking about that recording in just a few minutes. Ethan Iverson is appearing at Crooners in Fridley on Saturday evening at 7 p.m. with Kevin Washington on drums and bassist Anthony Cox. Ethan, welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on your show.
So I read that you're from Wisconsin. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your connection to this area of the country, to maybe the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and to Wisconsin.
Yes, Peter, of course. Well, I'm from Menominee, Wisconsin, which is on 94, headed east out of the Twin Cities. It's on the way to Eau Claire. It's a pretty decent little college town. It has UW Stout there, and it's really a wonderful place to grow up, and I'll always love the Midwest. My parents, both of them, were originally from the Duluth area, and my brother still lives in Duluth. The Bad Plus was sort of a Minnesota group, Dave King and Reed Anderson, both from Golden Valley. So my connections and my roots here in this area are, it's very profound. I don't know if any of your listeners would remember this, but a few years ago, there was a wonderful spot in Menominee called The Creamery, which was a little restaurant. They had a piano, and all through my high school years, I played at The Creamery Friday and Saturday nights playing jazz standards. That's sort of how I learned my craft. And it turns out not every small town has an opportunity like that. I've been around the world and talked to all these great musicians, and I'm actually one of the few who had a job playing jazz in high school. So, very grateful for all of that.
So, in addition to being a recording artist, you're also an educator. Are you still with New England Conservatory?
Yes, I am. I've been teaching at New England Conservatory for 7 or 8 years, and school starts next week.
And I don't know where you have the time to do all of this, but you're also a pretty prolific writer about not only music, but also about crime fiction.
I was always a big reader. I think that was the influence of my mother. She liked crime fiction, and this will probably sound pretentious, but I do see a correlation with music in the sense that I'm interested in genre and that there's a box or a frame. How do you fill the picture frame? And if it's a piece of crime fiction, if it's a murder mystery, you know, there's only so many moves that you can do to complete this puzzle. And if you're playing a jazz standard like Stella by Starlight at the club, there's only a certain number of variations you can do. But that doesn't mean it's not interesting. In fact, it's almost more interesting when there's a set puzzle or a certain set of parameters that you need to follow. So I guess, you know, again, that's probably pretty pretentious, but I see it as honest continuum. Anyway, I can't say that writing about crime fictions will help me play with Anthony Cox and Kevin Washington this coming weekend, but it's somehow it is all part of the same thing.
So I've been reading your blog since it was Do the Math, and I read Substack every chance I have that I have the opportunity. And one thing I've noticed is that your interest is not only in contemporary music, but expands to like the very earliest styles of jazz and also contemporary classical music. But specifically with respect to early styles of jazz, and like, you know, maybe you're writing about Willie the Lion Smith, or maybe you're writing about Herbie Nichols, or maybe James P. Johnson. What do you gather from paying attention to these early styles? You know, someone else may dismiss early jazz recordings, you know, say pre-Monk, as being out of date or outmoded. Do you still find inspiration in these things?
Well, That's a great point, Peter, and I appreciate you bringing this up, because I do believe we live in, for lack of a better word, a postmodern environment. If we're speaking about jazz piano, once you get to Paul Blay and Cecil Taylor and those other 60s innovators, it's, you can't get more avant-garde, really. So now we have a whole continuum of things from very simple to very complex to sort of assess. And probably my peer group in the 90s were really interested in the big four, which was Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner, Keith Jarrett, and Chick Corea, plus Bill Evans. Those five still to this day define modern jazz piano to a certain extent. But I'm not sure if there's so much, you know, room to do something new with those languages. I can really hear it. If people are just influenced by Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, and McCoy Tyner, I really hear it. If people are really influenced by Bill Evans and Keith Jarrett, I really hear it. I don't know what there is to be done. But if you add in Thelonious Monk, if you add in Willie the Lion Smith, if you add in James P. Johnson, if you add in these early musicians, you might suddenly be able to reframe that modern jazz piano discourse in a fresh way. It can actually be, it's older, but it can be actually be fresher. And that's a big part of what I'm trying to do.
This is Peter Solomon. I'm speaking today with pianist Ethan Iverson about his most recent recording, Technically Acceptable, and his upcoming gig at Crooners featuring bassist Anthony Cox and drummer Kevin Washington. Can you talk a little bit about the impetus behind this second Blue Note recording that was just released this year, Technically Acceptable? What brought about this album?
Well, there's a few different factors on the album. It's mostly my original pieces, and they're sort of in two groups. One is relatively direct pieces for piano trio, and I've been writing those, I suppose, for a long time, 35 years or something. But I'm pretty proud where they've gotten quite memorable. I feel like I can write hummable new tunes. That's what I'm playing with Thomas Morgan and Kush Abadi. Then there's this piano sonata, which is completely written out in three movements. And I believe it's the first really visible sonata written by a jazz musician. It's certainly the first on Blue Note Records. So those are the two streams I'm dealing with. You mentioned that I write about classical music quite a bit on my Substack, and it's actually a big part of my personality is formally notated music in the European tradition.
The last three tracks in your recording, you've referenced just a moment ago, a piano sonata in three movements. I was thinking about the essay you wrote for the New York Times earlier this year that was kind of dealing with George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which is obviously a beloved piece of popular music that draws on jazz and classical music, but has been put in its place in terms of not necessarily being as successful a piece of music as it might have been. You take it to task specifically with the way that the piece handles rhythm. And I was wondering if you could talk about what you find as the shortfall in that piece and how you avoid those pitfalls when you're writing something that's drawing on classical and jazz.
The piece is called The Worst Masterpiece, Rhapsody Blue at 100. And it's very hard to be a masterpiece, so I'm calling it a masterpiece, but I also think it's closed the door, that the point about American music should be this melting pot ethos. American classical musicians, if they come out of the conservatory, they actually aren't trained in rhythm, and you don't need to really know rhythm to play Rhapsody in Blue. However, you can say, well, we're doing jazz on our concert program at Tanglewood tonight because we're playing Rhapsody in Blue. That's been this placeholder for 100 years. And it's just not good enough anymore. We need to train our American musicians of any discipline to deal with rhythm and, frankly, black music. In my piano sonata, there are a couple of indications. I say the bass part of the first movement should be played like Wilbur Ware, the great jazz bassist. There's another part in the slow movement where I say, play it like Bobby Timmons, the legendary Philadelphia hard bop pianist. In the last movement, I say, this is like Mead Lux Lewis, one of the all-time great boogie-woogie pianists. These references should actually be understood by all American musicians who are serious. They are generally not understood by so-called classical musicians who are in the American Academy. So I do think part of what I'm trying to do with the sonata is actually not criticize Gershwin, but to take up what Gershwin is proposing. Gershwin was right. It was just a long time ago. It was 1924. Duke Ellington had barely made a record. I'm not blaming Gershwin for anything. The piece is really good. But the idea of it, we need it more than ever in a way. And I like to think if Gershwin heard my piece, he'd actually understand what I'm trying to do.
So there's a kind of slight nod to Stanley Crouch, because the second track on the album, this is one that we've actually played quite a bit here on Jazz 88, Victory is Assured, a la Brev. Apparently that's a phrase that you found in Stanley Crouch's writing. I encountered him a couple of times earlier in my career, and I know him to be a writer of great insight and humor and sometimes very provocative. Can you talk about your acquaintance with Crouch? I mean, were you friends, or did he influence you in any way?
Well, I grew up reading Stanley Crouch, and I always enjoyed his writing. And then when I met him in New York, it was just really fantastic. It was just fantastic to know him. Both my wife and I got to know him pretty well. And he was a legendary New York character. You know, I miss these people. When they go, they don't get replaced, at least as far as I can tell. I got to know the owner of the Village Vanguard pretty well, Lorraine Gordon. Amazing New York character. Stanley Crouch, the same thing. I mean, someone who made New York, New York. He is really controversial to this day. You know, I will see things on my social media feed that are like angry about Stanley Crouch. And I actually think that's a very short-sighted perspective, because I think Stanley can teach just about anybody if you're willing to learn. I mean, not everybody gets it right all the time. And Stanley had a certain way that was quite arrogant at times. But he also knew what he was talking about. So in my opinion, he has the right to, shall we say, go off the way he does. Victory is Assured is his catchphrase. He signed every email that way, and it's in the frontispiece of all of his books. And when I came up with this piece, I suddenly realized that Stanley might like it. I don't know if he really would, but it's sort of like just a Count Basie blues swinging down the middle. That was what he really wanted. He really wanted modern jazz not to stop innovating, but to always include this Afro-American blues element. If you could include that in your music, if you could have that blues and dance element there, he would like it. He wasn't really conservative, but he wanted that to be acknowledged. And the older I get, the more I think he was basically right about that.
Can you talk about the musicians you'll be working with on Saturday, Anthony Cox and Kevin Washington?
Well, I feel blessed to be playing with both Anthony Cox and Kevin Washington. They're great musicians. The first time I saw Anthony was actually in 91, maybe 1990, playing with Jerry Allen and Verona Clough in Minneapolis. That was a great gig, one of the greatest gigs I've ever seen. And I've seen Anthony play over the years, have a lot of records that he's on. The Twin Cities is lucky to have an Anthony Cox on the scene. He recommended Kevin Washington. I think the first time I played out there with Anthony in the post bad plus years for me, I called Anthony. I said, who should I get for drums? And he said, well, what about Kevin Washington? And it felt great. Kevin's a world-class drummer. So we don't want to overthink this. It's going to be a lot of standards and some of my easiest pieces. But this is probably about the fourth time we've done it, either the third or fourth time. And it's always been a blast. And I'd like to think they have a good time doing it too. So certainly looking forward.
I've been speaking with pianist Ethan Iverson. His most recent release on Blue Note Records is called Technically Acceptable. He's appearing in Fridley at Crooners on the main stage Saturday, August 31st, with Anthony Cox on bass and drummer Kevin Washington. I'm Peter Solomon for Jazz 88.